Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. In this podcast, we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. Today, we're talking about six countries in the heart of Europe: Albania, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo, Montenegro, North Macedonia, and Serbia, known collectively as the Western Balkans. On a recent tour of the region, EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen pledged 6 billion euros to help bring about the reforms necessary to make EU membership a reality. We're asking how broader geopolitical shifts, from Russia's invasion of Ukraine to the rise of China, are impacting this process, and how the European Union now faces competition from Moscow and Beijing when it comes to vying for influence in the region. We'll also ask how recent tensions within the Western Balkans could impede EU accession plans. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to unpack these issues, I'm joined as ever by two veritable experts, the first of whom is Dr. Marina Vulovic, whose research at SWP explores, among other issues, the geostrategic importance of the Western Balkans for the EU and beyond. Marina, it's great to have you in the studio today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And joining us down the line from Austria is Florian Bieber, a professor at the University of Graz. Florian coordinates the Balkans in Europe Policy Advisory Group and works on questions of nationalism and European integration. Florian, welcome and thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So the European Union and the Western Balkans have a fairly complex relationship with many ups and downs. How does this affect accession talks? And what are the main hurdles currently obstructing the path to EU membership? Florian, what are the challenges within the region?
Yeah, thanks. I think in the region, one big challenge is the lack of democracy in quite a few countries, or the fact that democracy is under pressure. In particular, I'm thinking of Serbia, which has long not been a democracy, but rather moved towards the territory of hybrid or competitive authoritarian regimes. And there we doubt, first of all, whether the government is actually interested in European integration, and also joining the EU requires to be a democracy. And so that in itself constitutes an obstacle. And then I would say in the region, we have a number of unresolved issues which keep flaring up. We've seen tensions between Serbia and Kosovo escalating with violence, but also in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the state remains fragile and is continuously challenged, in particular by the Serb-dominated entity Republika Srpska. So there are all these issues which really obstruct the kind of focus on the reforms it takes to join the European Union. And then overall, citizens have lost faith in the process. I mean, it's been 20 years since the EU promised EU membership to the Western Balkans, and only Croatia joined. So many citizens really don't believe it anymore. And so they don't pressure their governments to really do what it takes to join the European Union. And without that kind of push, it's very hard to bring through the necessary reforms and transformation the countries need to join the European Union.
And Marina, what about the hurdles within the EU? I'm guessing this is not just a one-sided issue.
Definitely not one-sided. I mean, the main challenge I identify there is really lack of willingness to enlarge and implement necessary institutional reforms in the EU itself, because the European Union has been going through several crises for the past 15 years. We've had the financial crisis in 2008-2009, then we had the migration crisis, quote unquote, then we had Brexit, then we had the coronavirus pandemic, we had Russia's invasion of Ukraine. All of these issues, of course, impact on the unity of the European Union and, of course, on the, smooth sailing and functioning of EU institutions as well. And so because of these crises, we have a phenomenon that's called enlargement fatigue within the European Union. So the European Union doesn't really have, enough motivation to actually enlarge. But I also have to say, in the aftermath of Russia's attack on Ukraine, we've seen signs of this actually beginning to change.
Well, in light of these challenges, in particular from Russia, as you say, is Brussels now starting perhaps to change its attitude towards enlargement? And does it even see it as a way to secure peace? And if so, have there been any concrete steps to reflect such a change of heart? Marina, perhaps you could continue there.
Yeah, there were definitely a few concrete steps. So countries, for instance, that were previously really vehemently opposing EU enlargement, such as France and the Netherlands, are now actually changing their minds. So we've seen also greater alignment between France and Germany on, you know, realizing that enlargement is a geopolitical necessity. So, you know, enlargement is a tool for the European Union to guarantee stability and prosperity in its neighborhood, basically. And so this concerns the Western Balkans as well. It is also believed that only as part of the European Union that the region can actually, you know, have sustainable peace and stability in the future. However, it also needs to be emphasized that we'll have EU elections next year. And so, you know, we will see whether there is continuity and consensus on enlargement in the next legislative period, because this is an open question still.
And Florian, how do you see it?
I might be a little bit more pessimistic than Marina is, because they are what I call a false friends of enlargement. I mean, countries which are formally in favor of enlargement, which have not been really helping the process. Hungary, for example, with Viktor Orban, has been pushing for enlargement, but has been undermining the process because many citizens and governments in the EU feel like his push for enlargement is actually to get more autocrats in the union to, you know, protect him, and that's hardly doing a helpful service, rendering a helpful service to the Western Balkans. Or we have countries like Bulgaria, which was in the past a strong advocate of enlargement, but has blocked North Macedonia and with it Albania for quite some time, and North Macedonia still is stuck because of Bulgarian intransigence when it comes to kind of nationalist questions. And this is the problem, is that it's not just the countries which were skeptics, but it's also the countries which, you know, are neighbors of the Western Balkans and which might use bilateral disputes to block the whole process. And at the end of the day, the process has not really delivered for 20 years, except for Croatia. And so the question is, even with this renewed commitment, is it really enough to bring the countries in? Or do we need a new process which really kind of creates a more dynamic situation where really the countries can see the light at the end of the tunnel?
So assuming it is a serious endeavor, EU enlargement aims to bolster security, but the Western Balkans is seeing increased tensions. Tell me about these, Florian. What or who is hampering stability and peace within the region?
Well, I think it's to a large degree those elites which are autocratic, and in particular, I'm thinking of Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić, who's been becoming increasingly authoritarian. And many observers, including myself, have called him both a pyromaniac and a firefighter. He creates the crisis he's promising to resolve afterwards, and he's basically selling the European Union a false sense of stability, of saying, you know, there are crises there, but I can manage them as long as you support me, as long as you are on my side. And that is, the EU is paying a very high price for it, because basically it's not addressing the fundamental problems in the region. And you're having a pyromaniac being leading the dominant country in the region and also being able to create these crises. Now, he's not the only pyromaniac, but he's certainly the worst one in the region. And then there are lots of others who are in a certain way benefiting from these crises. And they're often serving very domestic political needs, and they're playing on nationalism, on historical revisionism. They're undoing a lot of the peace work which has been done after the end of the wars of the 1990s in terms of dealing with the past, acknowledging the crimes. And so in that sense, the region is now less willing to acknowledge the crimes of the past than it was maybe a decade or 15 years ago.
Marina, how do you see the situation?
Yeah, in a very similar manner, you know, Florian talked about the authoritarian leaders who are igniting specific crises in order to be those who are actually able to relax said crises. That also goes back to bilateral disputes, you know, between Serbia and Kosovo. I think that one should be mentioned first. And then, of course, within Bosnia and Herzegovina. And both of those conflicts are, you know, legacies of wars of Yugoslav succession of the 1990s, but very much, you know, being perpetuated as crises by these leaders. So I would definitely agree on that.
And Marina, what about the risk of violence there in the region?
I'd say, you know, the highest risk of violence definitely exists between Serbia and Kosovo, specifically in the north of Kosovo, where we've seen in the last year, basically, a lot of escalation happen continuously, and a lot of destabilization happens. So you know, I also don't really expect that there would be outright war, because I don't think that currently Serbia would really also profit from that. I also don't think that generally people in the region would go to war after, you know, having lived through war basically 25 years ago. So it was really very recent. However, you know, as Florian already mentioned, there's this idea that certain leaders in the region are constantly destabilizing specific territories, basically, to advance their own policy agendas. So I think that's really what's happening there. And I would also say that as long as there is a strong KFOR presence, specifically in Kosovo, that that really acts as a deterrent from escalation into an outright war.
Yes, I think Marina is right on that, to note that the risk of a new war is very limited. There's in Bosnia Herzegovina as well, the EU4 peace presence. They're quite small, but symbolically important. Neither the EU nor NATO would be willing to risk the whole peace, especially with the larger European repercussions for some kind of conflict. But the risk is really this localized violence, as we've seen at the end of September in Banska in northern Kosovo, where we don't exactly know to this day what happened, but it's these incidents which can escalate, and which can even escalate sometimes beyond the control of the political leaders who might play with them for their own benefits. But if they have an environment where violence occurs, where people die, there might be a moment when this kind of violence becomes less manageable, even for those who are toying with it. And I think this is the real risk. It's not about a real fully fledged war, but this kind of violence can really undo a lot in terms of inter-ethnic relations, in terms of democracy, as well as in terms of political and security stability in the region, even if it's short of a full-scale war.
And looking beyond the EU, what role do Russia and China in particular play in the region? How influential are both Moscow and Beijing? And could their influence even prevent Western Balkan countries from joining the EU, Florian?
Well, I think it's important to notice that they are both actors which are not necessarily having a completely identical agenda in the region. I mean, Russia has had an interest in obstructing EU and NATO integration of the Western Balkans. It's not succeeded in North Macedonia and failed in Montenegro as well. So its influence is quite limited. And of course, I would say the war in Ukraine has further reduced its influence. It can't really act without being visible and much attention being paid to it due to the kind of larger confrontation which is taking place across the European continent. I mean, China, on the other hand, has been much more interested in economic influence, but both of them are only able to act because they have local leaders who are seeing them as useful actors, who see them as useful in reducing EU influence, in funding intransparent projects which might help them in election time. So in that sense, it's really these gatekeeper elites which are crucial in enabling the influence of Russia and of China, rather than that these two countries can just act autonomously and do what they please in the region. So the problem is really the elites who see personal benefits, sometimes enrichment, sometimes power, from bringing in those actors, be it economically or politically, to, in a certain way, reduce EU influence in the region.
And Marina, how serious a threat seen from Brussels are Russia and China?
Yeah, I would agree with Florian that, you know, Russia's influence is actually a bit overestimated, while China's influence is a bit underestimated. Specifically, when it comes to economic cooperation, China is a much bigger player and also likely to remain a bigger player in the near future. We've seen a much more growing, you know, economic engagement of China in the Western Balkans. For instance, in Serbia, it's become the single biggest donor when it relates to FDIs, so foreign direct investments, in 2022. Almost on par with the entire European Union. And we've seen a growing trend in the last few years. So this is definitely a concern when you look at how, you know, synergy effects are created between authoritarian leaders in the region, as well as authoritarian-led countries or foreign powers that have a vested economic interest in the region. We've seen that with Russia creating energy dependencies in the region, but we might also observe that with China in the near future. However, I would also like to emphasize that I don't think that China would really profit from obstructing the EU integration of the Western Balkans, simply because it would much more profit from an EU integrated region, whereas that is really not the fact with Russia.
Can I jump in here. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Marina, but I would just add that maybe the way which China engages in the region undermines the EU integration. It's not doing it deliberately, but rather that it's investing because it does dirty energy, dirty factories, which, you know, the countries cannot bring into the European Union. And it reinforces kind of authoritarianism because it does business with anybody in very intransparent ways. So in a certain way, China doesn't oppose the countries joining the EU, but what it does in the region in effect undermines the EU integration of the countries.
Yes, I mean, we've seen a kind of a corrosive effect of Chinese investments, specifically when it comes to, you know, rule of law and when it comes to upholding environmental standards in the region. So there's definitely synergies between how China is acting and Chinese investors are acting in, let's say, Serbia. We have, I can just maybe give two examples, the Bor copper mine and the Smederevo steel plant in Serbia, where both were basically bought by Chinese investors, and neither of them are really upholding the pollution limits in those cities. So those are usually very much over the legislated limit. And Serbia is actually not forcing these investors to install very expensive filters, either, you know, through lack of willingness or through lack of means. So, you know, the Serbian authorities either are not able or not willing to regulate that type of Chinese activity. So there's definitely some corrosive effect of said investment that Florian mentioned might actually hamper the EU integration of the region.
And I'm guessing the EU is wise to all of this and has recently signalled that it might be ready for enlargement by 2030. Marina, how realistic is this target date, considering everything you've both mentioned about willingness, lack of willingness, fatigue on both sides, and what can be done actually to bring the region closer to the EU?
I'll maybe first start with the second question, what can be done, and then go over to what is actually, or whether it's realistic. I think, you know, what is definitely needed is reviving the reform process in the region. And I think that can be achieved through specific modifications to the EU enlargement process, as well as, you know, offering maybe bigger carrots for the region to advance. But this also does not concern or wouldn't be enough of an incentive for all the countries in the regions, in the region. But, you know, Florian already mentioned that there are these authoritarian leaders that don't really profit from EU integration. So actually implementing the reforms that the European Union wants from them would actually jeopardize their power. So they don't really have an interest to advance in this process. But for the other countries who are not part of this, you know, authoritarian trap, in a sense, creating more realistic interim milestones like membership in the single market of the European Union might be beneficial, because it would also offer more EU financing coupled with reforms. So as I mentioned, these bigger carrots. I also think that, you know, a clearer and more honest communication on the part of the European Union is definitely needed. So if decisions are geopolitical, they should also be named as such and not kind of cloaked under the rhetoric of reforms, because this can only reinforce authoritarian leaders if countries are actually, granted something on their EU integration path and have not implemented any significant reforms. It sends bad signals. And lastly, you know, reforming the decision-making processes within the European Union that minimize the credibility of the EU membership promise. Florian has already mentioned the frequent vetoes that were issued for the EU integration process of several countries, particularly North Macedonia. And I think this, you know, reforming the decision-making processes when it comes to enlargement is definitely a necessary step to make the process much more lively. But just to kind of connect to your question, whether it's realistic 2030, I don't think EU integration as such is realistic by 2030. But, you know, maybe membership in the EU single markets for specific countries like, let's say, Montenegro, which is considered the front runner, might actually be more realistic.
Right, and enlargement isn't just about the Western Balkans. Florian, how realistic do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Marina's assessment overall, and I would say that 2030 is a good date, not as in a date where all the countries can join, but rather because then also these dates get abused by local leaders who kind of suggested and sell it to their publics as an kind of automatism, which it can't be possibly. But I think what it could do is it could focus minds in the European Union to the reforms which Marina's mentioned, that getting the EU ready by 2030, that it is able to accept new members, that is, I think, important, and to signal to the countries that if you do your job, you could join by 2030. And there, it would be helpful to outline exactly what do the governments need to do to achieve this date, so that citizens can compare their government's achievements with the possibilities which they could do. Because that would be very helpful, so that citizens can see if their government is actually not doing what it takes to join the European Union. So if the message is, we will do what it takes for you to join, and if you want to, if you do what it takes on your side, you could make it by 2030, but this means by 2025 to do this, by that year to do that, so that it's very clear for citizens to kind of measure, because this is the problem. It's very abstract. It's a very complicated process. An ordinary citizen in Serbia, in Montenegro, I mean, you know, the same in an EU member state, wouldn't be able to understand what it means. And so what you have to break it down into tangible kind of goals, and that communicate that to the public. This is one of the problems. The EU has allowed governments in the region to communicate the EU enlargement process directly. And as a result, the EU has lost in a certain way the ability to interpret and to be clear in outlining also the flaws. So when somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to do, the EU should say so very clearly. In recent years, they've been often kind of sugarcoating their language, and there are more clarity. Also, criticism should be there, because if governments are actually interested in the joining, they should take criticism as well. And I feel like the very kind of very great reluctance of EU officials to criticize people like Aleksandar Vučić, but also other leaders in the region, it doesn't help the cause of bringing the countries into the European Union. So more clarity, more tangible interim benchmarks, deadlines, which are visible to citizens, all of that together would really help the process overall.
So it's a comms challenge as much as anything else. Well, an EU enlargement isn't just about the Western Balkans. What about Ukraine? Is the focus on Ukraine right now joining the EU potentially at some point? Is that helping or perhaps even hindering the process for the Western Balkans, Florian?
Well, I think many citizens and governments in the Western Balkans feel like they're a little bit put in the shadow of Ukraine. Ukraine is getting all the attention. And I even worry that Ukraine might kind of overtake the Western Balkans. But I would take a rather different line. I would think that it actually helps the region. Put it on the agenda again. Enlargement is become a priority issue in Brussels, which it wasn't before. So, for example, we're going to most likely see a commissioner in charge of enlargement next year who is more of a heavyweight and less obstructionist than Viktor Orban's candidate who's doing the job right now. So overall, Ukraine might steal some of the thunder for the Western Balkans, but it has the real potential for giving it the political will in the European Union the process hasn't had. So overall, I would say it's more helpful than disruptive.
Well, that's all we have time for on the podcast today. I'd like to thank our guests, Marina Vulović and Florian Bieber. You'll find links to their latest work in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guests.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
And also from me, Esme Nicholson, thank you for tuning in.